ever heard of heavy work before, OTs preach about this because this is an input that is inherently calming to the nervous system. So think of people right now that love weightlifting or yoga or massage. It's all providing sensory, heavy work, proprioceptive input to the nervous system, which is calming. So if you can have him, you know, hold the big heavy door open to let all of the classmates in first, so that way he's last in the classroom. He gets a little bit more of a standing break. He's holding a heavy door open. He has a job, and then he can go in and transition after. That's kind of adding a lot of the components into it that can help him regulate. You could have him help collect books, pass out papers, you know, collect toys, something that's giving him a job, but also offering heavy work that can help regulate him.
Join the Patreon and join the conversation. You can submit your very own questions. You can be right there with us while we discuss them. And you can also get access to one-on-one coaching.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership Parenting and Teaching Podcast, where I introduce you to people who can help you on your parenting, teaching, caregiving, leadership journey. Today, I have an occupational therapist with us today, and her name is Laura, also known as the OT Butterfly on Instagram. And I don't know if she's on TikTok, but I'm going to have her introduce herself, share a little bit about who she is, what she does, what her background is, and then we're going to dive right in with the questions as we have the tendency to do. Go ahead.
Perfect. Thanks for having me, Chaz. I'm super excited. You know, I've been a fan of yours on Instagram. I love all your advice that you give to parents. I'm so excited to be able to teach parents a little bit more about occupational therapy and our lens at childhood development. And so I am a pediatric OT. My specialty is with children ages 3 to 12. And I work with kids who have sensory processing disorder. I also work with kids who have autism, some kids who have ADHD, with or without a diagnosis, any child that displays difficulty functioning and participating in meaningful daily activities. So that's kind of vague, but when we really look at what is important for a child's daily activities, we look at their participation in academics at school, in social participation, in the community at school and at home, and then all of the things that happen at home with mom and dad, with themselves, with play, with grooming activities, doing homework, playing with siblings, and just really participating in what is important and meaningful to life. So occupational therapists help develop and refine motor skills, but my specialty is really looking at sensory processing and how that actually impacts behavior. And I say that because there is a big debate on finding out the underlying cause of behavior. And a lot of parents want to know the difference between something that's sensory or behavior. But I really want to shift the mindset for parents and caregivers and teachers to think that sensory is behavior. We just really need to understand, look at what the behavior is and understand if there is a sensory trigger, which we can help, or if there's something else that's going on. But it's all a behavior, and behavior is not a scary word. So that's kind of my frame of reference. I'm also a mom to a 3.5-year-old girl. She is a firecracker. If you follow me on Instagram, you know her. She has anxiety and SPD. So I have both hats here. I have mom, I have clinician, and I completely get the parent perspective of being completely overwhelmed and not knowing where to start. So that's why I'm so passionate in advocating and helping parents really understand this information.
So why do you think it's so important to, you know, not make the distinction between, like, is it behavioral or is it sensory?
Yeah, I think it's really important because right from the get-go, if you are trying to identify if something is behavioral or sensory, what I hear and what I think parents or teachers are trying to understand is, what's causing this? Is this something my child can't help, which is that sensory piece? Is it something that's out of their control? Or are they trying to get my attention? Are they trying to be bad? And parents want kind of to understand that, because then they want the permission sometimes to do some kind of disciplinary plan or some sort of timeout or some sort of parent strategy that might work for other kids. But what that does, then it kind of sets kind of like a negative connotation, and it brings that mindset when you're talking to that child or trying to figure out what's happening. It already brings it to that kind of negative kind of connotation, that feeling of it, versus coming to it with an understanding of, okay, this is what's happening, and you wanting to work with them and really trying to help them and support them through it. And I also think just the word behavior gets such a bad rap from, like, you know, from old school times, when it's like bad behavior or misbehavior, just something that just has such a negative connotation to it, when behavior is really just communication, right? And so we're just trying to understand, what are they trying to communicate? How can I help them? Because our kids don't, especially sensory processing challenged kids, they don't understand their body well enough. They don't understand why they respond to certain things a certain way. And they don't understand that we don't respond the same way. So they don't understand, like, why don't you get me? And why is my body doing this? I don't know, but I need to do this behavior to get this input or to avoid this input. And you're missing a whole part of it if you're just looking at it from behavior. And I think the part about behavior is, when you look at something as just a behavior, a lot of times we just focus on what happened just right before that, like, immediate trigger, that immediate antecedent. But it's not just about that. It could be something that happened hours ago, or a culmination and adding up, a buildup of things throughout the day that you might miss if you just look at it as, like, what caused this behavior, or, you know, making it separate.
Yeah, you know, and part of what I'm hearing is that when part of the reason why it's important for to kind of change the mindset of is that children really do the best when they can. And, you know, it's parents or teachers or trying to, you said, get the permission, but it's almost like, should it be me against my child, or should it be me trying to help my child through this? And I think the answer is always me trying to help my child through this. Even if it feels, you know, sometimes we feel like personally attacked, but it could be a multitude of things that is, you know, creating the behavior. And you mentioned a few, but just to add a few, like the climate, the feel of the room, just the overall relationship that they have, the associations that they make from one thing to another thing. And, you know, and when we take a position of mindset of, you know, first curiosity, like, okay, what's going on, you know, underneath? What is that underlying thing that is happening that is causing the behavior? And when we first approach with curiosity, and then figure out how we can help them through it. And I just made a video today about, I was talking about, like, the gap, right? The idea that, you know, children should know better, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't even hold ourselves to that same standard. And there's a big gap between the knowing better and knowing and the doing, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of things that sit in that gap for us too as adults, not just for children, for us too as adults, right? We know that, you know, it's not the best practice to procrastinate on things, yet we still do it, right? We know what our unhealthy habits are, but we still engage in them, and we don't replace them with healthy habits a lot of times. We know the speed limit is 55 miles per hour on the highway, but we're still going 60, 65. And what sits in that gap is could be a multitude of things, right? Mm-hmm. It could be sensory. It could be anxiety. It could be depression. It could be, you know, peer pressure. It could be a sense of wanting love and belonging. And when we completely ignore the thing that's in the gap and we just jump to the behavior, we miss the opportunity to address those things in the gap and actually close the gap between the knowing and the doing.
Yeah. I often say you have to decide, is it a can't or a won't? So that's really where it's like, they can't do something because there's a gap. There's a skills gap there, whatever that skills gap is: processing sensory input, communicating, managing emotions, regulating your feelings, all of those things. If that's a can't, then you really have to address that can't, versus won't, which, you know, a lot of times we talk about this trying to connect with our children. There are some times where there's kids who are kids and they are doing, sometimes there's like a power for control, and there's kids who are testing their limits. And there are some kids who will do that because they're kids and they're still kind of learning about that thing. So not everything is sensory. But I think it is important to look at it from like a skills gap, where it's our responsibility to teach them how to get through these things versus won't because they don't want to turn the TV off, right? Something like that. Those are just part of typical children things, but yeah.
And even with the won't, with the turning the TV off and the, you know, the power, even there in the won't is a need or a lack of skill. And the won't of the, I won't turn the TV off is it's, you know, it's hard for me to transition from this thing that I'm completely engaged in and immersed in. I know sometimes it's hard for me to get off of TikTok at the end of the night, and I know I need to wake up in the morning, you know, and you know, that's hard. That's a legitimately hard thing. And even for power, there's a need of feeling, you know, significant, to feel like I have a say in the matter. Mm-hmm. And so even in the wants, there are still, you know, can't that can be addressed to make those things that they won't do easier for them to do, give them tools so they can see it, so they know what's coming next, you know, something simple as, you know, of giving them warnings before you turn the TV off, comparing some of those things of those won'ts to, you know, to wills.
Right.
And it's not always, rarely ever, you know, simple, and it's rarely ever easy to just, you know, figure out. And we're busy, and there's so many things, whether you're in a classroom or you're, you're in your house, we're adults and we're busy. And so we're not always, you know, focused or present or like really paying attention to the things that we can do to help our child through the things that they have challenges with. In the classroom, it's really hard because there are, you know, you might have 10, 15, 20 different individuals with different needs. And in a household, it's, you know, hard too, because it's, you know, you still different children, different people in the house with different needs, because you as the adult have needs too, right? And the things that you're focused on. But it's, you know, but there's always opportunity for us to take a step back, to get curious, and to really figure out what that the underlying thing is. And I actually have, we're going to get to someone in our community, or someone in my community asked a question, a pretty detailed question that we're going to get into. And so I'm going to love to pick that apart. But before we go into it, I want to talk about hitting. Because hitting is probably one of the most common things that I hear that concerns teachers and parents the most. I think it can be very triggering for a lot of people too, even if it's just a toddler who's hitting, or like a one-year-old even hitting with their one-year-old strength, it can still feel triggering to, you know, the adult. Right. And so that can make it even harder to handle, because we're getting in our emotions. But when we understand it a little bit more, we have a better understanding, a better, you know, perspective as to why it's happening. That can a lot of times release some of that stress and some of the how much it triggers us, because we have a better understanding. So we know where it's coming from. We know how to address it. And we don't think that, you know, this toddler who's having a hard time is going to grow up to become a, you know, woman abuser, or is going to, you know, be in prison and go to jail for the rest of their life because they're going to, you know, right? And a lot of times, and it might sound silly to some people who are out there, but a lot of times that is where our mind goes.
Yeah.
And when our mind is in, you know, we start to treat them like a convict or a felon. And when we do that, we're likely not in a headspace to really help them what that underlying problem is. So in your experience, what are some of the common reasons that you see hitting happen, and what are some things that you do to help that child and the teachers and parents?
No one told us the truth about parenthood. Why? This is the podcast everyone needed before they had kids, because now that those little ones are here, whew, there is a lot to unpack. I'm Rachel Shepardota, and I am your host for the podcast No One Told Us, where we tell the truth about parenting and let you in on all the stuff you really should have known about before having kids. I am the founder of Hey Sleepy Baby, but this podcast is so much more than sleep. We'll be diving into all the topics that you really care about and need to know while you do your best job raising those adorable, tidy humans. Our goal is to just make you feel less alone and less overwhelmed. There are so many things that no one tells us before becoming a parent, and I think that we should really pull back the curtain on becoming a first-time or second-time mom or dad to share the good, the bad, and the ugly. We'll have a little education, a little fun, and a whole lot of heart that goes into each and every episode. So join me and our amazing guests each week to hear us talk about what no one told us.
I'm Margaret.
And I'm Amy.
And together we host the podcast, What Fresh Hell? Laughing in the Face of Motherhood.
Margaret, I would say you're sort of a where are my keys kind of mom.
Correct. Sometimes a where are my kids kind of mom. While you're, Amy, more of a we were supposed to leave 35 seconds ago, mom.
I mean, touche. In each episode of What Fresh Hell, we come at a topic from our usually completely opposite perspectives. I bring the research.
And I bring kind of the gimlet eye. Like, is that research really going to work, people?
And almost 10 million downloads later, we're still laughing.
We also talk to experts in the parenting field, plus parents with stories we can all learn from.
We make each other laugh, we challenge each other's assumptions, and we have what we think is the best parenting community on the internet.
Check out What Fresh Hell, Laughing in the Face of Motherhood, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah. So let's look at it from a sensory perspective. There are two main sensory thresholds that I think apply to hitting. So the one that I work with the most, the one that I'm most common with my daughter and what I teach in my membership with my parents is from a sensory overload perspective. Think of everyone having a sensory cup, and kids who are sensory sensitive have a small sensory cup. I like to say my daughter has like a thimble size cup. Like it's so tiny, it overflows very, very fast. So any kind of input, bright lights, loud sounds. And when I say loud sounds, like sometimes just regular talking voice, depending on the time of day, is too loud for her and she literally needs it like silent. Sometimes the sound of like an air conditioner vent can be too loud for a sensory sensitive child. So their thimble and their cup is just constantly get flowing to the top. And when you have an overflowing cup, that's when you see meltdowns. And what a meltdown is really that fight or flight mode. The lower brain part, the lower part of your brain where it's very primitive. It's a very emotional reaction that's involuntary. This is this fight or flight where you're trying to survive. This is like the part of the brain that would be triggered if you saw a bear. You would literally either freeze or like run as fast as you can in the other direction, right? In that moment, you're not going to be able to have a conversation. You're not going to be hungry. You're not going to be doing math equations. All of the things that don't matter, you are tunnel vision getting away from the bear. Or maybe you are fighting the bear. Whatever it is, you are keeping yourself alive. And when some kids in sensory overload, kids who have a small sensory cup, when they are pushed to their threshold, which is very low, their fight or flight can get triggered. So that's where hitting can happen. And I have seen this happen. I had a client who was very sensory defensive to the world. Like everything was too loud, too scary, too bright, everything. And he was particularly defensive from imposed touch, meaning someone else touching him, whether it was on accident, brushing up against his arm. So while I was working with him in the clinic and I was helping him move from one room to the other, and I just kind of gently had my hand on his shoulder to kind of guide him through to the direction where he needed. And he instantly like turned around and like scratched my arm. And even he was like surprised, like, sorry, I didn't, like he didn't even realize what he did. And I did an observation in the classroom and the same thing happened. He was in a circle time. They were playing marbles and a marble rolled under his leg and the classmate went to reach under it and grazed his leg and he scratched that kid's face. Mm-hmm. And to just someone who doesn't understand sensory, or maybe a teacher who's busy attending to lots of other things in the classroom, they turn around, they see a kid who's crying. What happened? This kid hit me. So the kid that hit, the behavior is now in trouble, in timeout, can't play with marbles, can't play with kids. And he's being punished or, you know, reprimanded for something that was truly fight or flight mode for him that he didn't understand. So that is one piece of the sensory. And that was just touch. You can have this fight or flight trigger to hit if something is too loud, if something is too bright, and it's just something that is too much for your nervous system to process. It's really a neurological threshold. It's something that's beyond control for these kids with sensory challenges. On the other side of it, there are kids who have a big sensory cup, sensory seekers. They can't get enough of the input, and they also don't register the input as often. So these are kids that have high pain tolerance. These are kids that squeeze too hard when they hug and they don't realize they're hugging too hard. These are kids that mean to give you a pat on the back and it's a slap on the back, and they really don't understand why. These are kids that really seek a lot of fast movement, jumping, crashing, and they might jump on a kid because they don't realize that kid doesn't like jumping like they do. So these kids are just really feeding their sensory cup, whether their cup is small and they need to avoid or get away from something, or it's big and they like that feeling of making contact with something or somebody, or they don't have an awareness of their strength, of their body, of what's happening. That's the sensory piece. Those are the pieces that I focus on and rule out before I address other things like social emotional pieces or other skills gaps.
So how do you rule out sensory? Because I've heard you mention that a couple of times. What are the things that you do? Like, what are you observing for? Like, what are you like seeing? Tell me about that process.
Yeah. So in a clinic, when I would do a sensory processing evaluation, we bring out a lot of different sensory activities for them to explore. So sometimes we'll play like a loud game, and I will be watching them as we're playing. I'll look at, you know, if they're blinking really like often, or if sometimes they'll show subtle signs of dysregulation. Sometimes it's obvious, they will move their body away. Sometimes it's super subtle, like kids, if it's touch and we're playing, I'll bring out shaving cream and we'll do a car wash, and if they'll engage with it, they'll touch it. But sometimes their mouth will kind of open involuntarily. Sometimes they'll have a little bit of excess saliva, which is a really subtle, soft sign that they're becoming a little dysregulated. Their brain is working really hard to process something that it shouldn't be that hard to process, right? So it's not always obvious, like crying or screaming when you're touching something, but it's a very subtle cue. Sometimes like dilated pupils, sometimes uncontrollable laughter. So I really look at how they're performing in front of me. But I also take parent report into account. Is there a pattern there? Are they noticing that their child hits every time there's water involved, whether it's washing hands, in the bath, washing hair, anytime they play with a sensory bin and their clothes get wet? There might be kind of a tactile touch over responsivity that I'm looking at. So it's not just an isolation, the one isolated incident when it's happening. It's kind of happening across context, across environments, and something that's consistent and happening often or with some sort of pattern. So it's a little bit of parent report and also then in-person assessment of noticing how they respond to different cues.
That's great. Thank you for that. Now I'm going to read off one of community members' questions. It's a little bit of a long one, and then let's talk about it. Dive a little bit deeper, use this to talk about what you think is going on, and I will add to. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
So this says, our son, and this came in just yesterday too. Our son is 4 years old. He's in pre-K. We started him virtually first in September 2020, only because we just had his baby brother in early September, and both my husband and I were going to be off work, so we felt it was good to keep him home and also be safe. The plan was to always put him back in person once our leave was up. So he went back in person, pre-K, in early November. And 3 weeks into him being in person, his school started calling us about his behavior, mainly that he was having a hard time transitioning from one activity to the next. The biggest one being when it was time to leave the playground. He runs away, doesn't want to leave. He does that with us too, and he gets upset when it's time to leave the playground. But we were always able to get him to leave without him showing us anything that seemed alarming to us. We saw it as normal four-year-old emotions. Most kids don't want the fun to stop, but in his school, they say he doesn't follow verbal instructions. I will also add that he did the exact same he did attend the exact same school for the Threes program, 2019-2020 school year, and there was never any mention of him having hit this behavior, any concerns. Sadly, that school year was cut short because the pandemic needed virtual Threes program from March to June. This last week, his behavior escalated. Per the director, there was one instance, him getting him out the playground where he kicked a teacher. And another instance where he opened the classroom door and ran down the hallway and down the stairs. Lastly, another day, also this past week, he was running around the classroom and he would run past other kids to tap, hit them in a playful manner, but it's not something the other kids were trying to do with him. So they are now saying he isn't safe for himself and other kids. Oh, and we are getting him evaluated. It's in progress. No concerns cognitively. He's pretty bright and knows a lot for a four-year-old, but he is defiant with a big personality. What are your thoughts on this, Laura?
So I hear that she is she's in the process of getting evaluated. So if I were to be called to come assess and do an observation, this is something that I would often get called for an observation. I would go to the playground, go to the classroom, talk to the teacher. And there are a few things I would look at and observe to understand and rule out kind of sensory challenges and kind of get a better picture of it. So one thing that I would look at is the times that he is trying to, it looks like his biggest way of communicating is that he clearly wants to stay on the playground. So maybe there's something there on the playground, that movement piece, aside from it being fun, all kids love the playground. But maybe there is a regulation piece there. Is there a lot of movement, especially running in the classroom, that's telling me maybe he's needing a little bit more movement to regulate, and he feels most regulated and in his zone, and his cup is at the just right level when he's on the playground. So beyond it just being fun, from a sensory perspective, he feels so regulated at that moment. So that's one piece that I might look at, and look at also the times in the classroom when he's running around or trying to leave. What's going on there? Has he been sitting for a long time? Is there an activity that he might need a little bit more support through and he doesn't know how to ask for help or doesn't feel comfortable asking for help? Is it from a sensory overload perspective, again, not knowing this child, where maybe inside the classroom, a lot of those sounds is too hard to tolerate in a closed room. Outside on a playground, it's a lot more open air. You can kind of have your own space, not as loud, not as many smells. I had a child who was very sensitive to the smell of perfume and snacks and food inside the classroom that they just wanted to run and escape from, right? So really looking at maybe if there's a time of day to maybe where is it always, you know, right before snack or recess when he's running and he's needing more incremental breaks, like that stretch in the morning before there's a break is too long and he needs movement breaks before. So really looking at the pattern. So that's what I would encourage mom to kind of look at. If you haven't already, ask the teacher for patterns. Like, what time is this happening? Is it always during the same activity? I found out after much digging from one a client of mine that it was always during circle time, and he was always paired with a child who had more of a big sensory cup, so he moved faster than the child who was very avoidant, and it was just too much differing sensory input that he got very overwhelmed in that instance. But you have to ask a lot of questions and try to see if there's a pattern there, if it's related to sensory or not. And then if you decide it is sensory and it looks like it's that, try to work with the teacher on offering classroom jobs so that there's more opportunity for him to get that movement throughout the day in the classroom. Also giving him jobs like trying to transition out from the playground. This is even for any child who this isn't a sensory challenge. If this is just them having a hard time with transition, let him be the line leader, or, you know, you get to round up your friends, call three friends over to the line, give him kind of a responsibility and let him be sort of in control, but have ownership that he can feel proud of. That might go a long way in having him kind of initiate the transition away from the playground. I also like giving jobs for them to do that involve heavy work. So if you've ever heard of heavy work before, OTs preach about this because this is an input that is inherently calming to the nervous system. So think of people right now that love weightlifting or yoga or massage. It's all providing sensory, heavy work, proprioceptive input to the nervous system, which is calming. So if you can have him, you know, hold the big heavy door open to let all of the classmates in first, so that way he's last in the classroom, he gets a little bit more of a standing break, he's holding a heavy door open, he has a job, and then he can go in and transition after. That's kind of adding a lot of the components into it that can help him regulate. You could have him help collect books, pass out papers, you know, collect toys, something that's giving him a job, but also offering heavy work that can help regulate him.
Yeah, and I would just add too, let me just add some ideas, because this is something that, you know, as a teacher, especially in the beginning of the year, that I go through every year. Especially, I mainly taught threes to fives. And so they're just, you know, different expectations from, you know, the 2-year-old classroom. And then when it came into my classroom, and there are a lot of the things that you said are some things that I did, but let me add a few other things to kind of help ease that transition from the going from outside to inside. One, he might need a little bit more preparation of knowing when outside time is ending. And I love the idea of giving him a job, having him be a part of transitioning everyone else in, right? So he can be, you know, yeah, sure, he can be the line leader, but then he can also be the one to call in everyone else. Mm-hmm. And I love to do like create a chant that everyone, when you get to the line, everyone like screams and yells, you know, not scream, but like chants, yeah. Sings, whatever. And it can be as simple as, pre-K, line up, pre-K, line up. It can be that simple. Preferably, I like the things that rhyme more, but having him be one of the first ones and, yeah. Oh, do you want to call it? Okay, yeah, you can call everyone to go in. So that makes kind of, you know, meets a need that, and maybe this isn't a need, but children do feel the need to be, you know, feel significant, to have power. And so making him a part of that transition, making him feel like significant and important by being the line leader, by helping to call everyone else in, by just holding the clipboard or, mm-hmm. you know, we call it a boo-boo bag, which is like the stuff that you take out in case someone gets, you know, hurt. So you can kind of like help in the moment. Little things like that can be things that can really help and ease that transition, especially if this is something it sounds like he's been just between the pandemic and him going to school and not going to school, that it's been a little inconsistent.
And new sibling, right? Newborn sibling. Right. Yeah. So that's a huge piece as well.
Right. So there's been a lot of changes and transitions over the course of the past year. And she mentions that, you know, in the threes classroom, there was never any behavior, you know, challenges that they had. And I would suspect that throughout the year, it was a lot more consistent, right? Mm-hmm. He didn't have as many changes happening. And we've all been having a lot of changes, and a lot of children have been really having a hard time with the inconsistencies that the pandemic has brought. And there's some level to that we don't have control over, but what we do have control over, you know, kind of easing the friction between what he's having a hard time with. And that's through, that can be through the things like giving him the boo-boo bag or the line leader and all of those things too. And then also prepping him ahead of time. You know, he might need that teacher to come up to him, you know, 10 minutes before, like, hey, in 10 minutes, like, get all your like wiggles out, make sure you're running and having fun, because we're going to go inside in 10 minutes and then come over in 5 minutes. The other children might not need that. The other children might be fine with the pre-K lineup, and they all come in line up. Different children need different things, and especially maybe during this time, he may really need that. He may not need it forever, but he may need it during this time because he's trying to get back into the swing of things and the inconsistencies. And I love what you said about the need for, like, you know, gross motor and movement. And I always talk about advertising what's coming next, right? And so not just, hey, we're going inside, but hey, we're going to go inside and we're going to play a game. We're going to go inside and we're going to do that like move around song that you like so much or whatever it is. Or we're going to do 10 jumping jacks when we go inside, just so they have something to move towards. And even if it's not, you know, even if they don't have something active to do, maybe because typically it's lunch afterwards and maybe there isn't, you know, there isn't much opportunity for the big gross motor. Maybe, you know, talking about what's for lunch and, you know, them, you know, they may not be able to help pass out the food anymore because we're in a pandemic and they used to be able to do that. And, but maybe there's another part that they can be, you know, turning the lights on or whatever it is. She also mentioned the running out of the classroom, which is, you know, that's really tough. I'm going to kind of approach it from a different couple perspectives because running out of the classroom and like, you know, and you said he like ran down the stairs from a childcare perspective, like that is really tough. And what most, you know, directors, like what's ringing in the back of their mind, what's going on, like hitting their brain stem is liability, because if he does, then a four-year-old can open up, you know, doors pretty well, and even some of the heavy ones, right? Mm-hmm. So if the four-year-old does run out the room and does run out in the, like, that's, you know, as a parent, you're probably gonna be pretty upset and like, how did my child get out? And there's also a lot, I don't know, like what state, or, but like, there's also a lot of like liability there because it is our job. It is the child gets your job to keep that child safe, and leaving the vicinity makes it really hard. And that teacher can't run after him because they have to stay within ratio. It is a really tough spot. And it's something that I dealt with too. And to be honest, it is probably the number one thing that children do get disenrolled for, and from what I've seen in my experience, and just because of that. Now, like I said, I went through that challenge, a child who was running out, and there were a lot of, you know, he was new to the classroom. You know, this particular child just did have a hard time in large group settings for a multitude of reasons. And, you know, this was the beginning of the year. And he also was disenrolled from a previous school. And, you know, that's how he came here. One of the things that I did to help him, like, just understand the boundary is we put up stop signs at all the doors. And then I kind of, like, introduced him, like, oh, that means stop. The door, like this sign, it means stop. And like we played a few games and we would go to like one door and we would put up our hand and we'd say stop. And we'd go to another door and put up our hand, look at it and say stop. And so we made it like a game and it was fun and it was enjoyable. But now every time that child went to the door, there was a visual reminder that to stop. And he would even, because observing, you know, you do the thing and then you observe and see what's, you know, how it's working. And I, you know, would see him kind of go to the door and him tell himself, stop, because he saw that visual reminder. So that's something else that I would suggest to do in terms of the, you know, being in. She just joined my community yesterday, so we haven't had an opportunity to do our one-on-one yet. So I hope this is helpful, but I would like to, you know, in those situations when he is, you know, when we're asking him to get off or to, you know, come off the playground and come inside, you know, you mentioned that he kicked a teacher. I know that happens a lot when that, like you said, that child's in that fight or flight mode and we're putting more pressure on him. And maybe it's appropriate the way that we're doing it. And, you know, maybe, you know, I can't really say, but I would ask more questions about how exactly that went down, because I just know in my experience, a lot of times the kicking is a response of, I don't feel safe. And, you know, you're in my grill. You're like, you're in my space and I'm just trying to protect myself. And so the kicking happens, just like you said, with the scratch. It's not a lot of times. It's not even, they catch yourselves after it happened. They're like, oh no, like I didn't, like, that's not what I intended to do. That's not what I meant to do, but it just happened. So I would ask more questions about exactly how that happened. And maybe there's a different way that we can approach it and do some of the things I mentioned before, or, you know, just now being proactive. Go ahead.
And now I think that's where it gets really tricky, because it's hard. I know myself as an outsider coming in to do the observation. And if you're a parent and trying to ask those questions, a lot of times I know this can be kind of feel like an attack to teachers, right? Or feel like we're saying the teacher did something wrong. But really, if we come at it saying, we're just trying to understand a little bit better. And especially, you know, again, my head goes to the sensory sensitive kids, the small sensory cup. They think a hand on the shoulder is like pushing them. They think you using more of an affirmative voice and maybe not talking so soft. But sometimes my daughter will like, stop yelling at me. I'm like, I'm not yelling at you. But they really perceive it as yelling. So then when they tell you, oh, I kicked her because she pushed me, it's like, well, the teacher didn't push you, but she was leading you out. But that can be where it's tricky, because I know as parents, if we hear our kids say your teacher put their hands on you, right, then it makes us worry what's going on. So, and we want to always understand our child and listen to them and give them the benefit of the doubt and hear them if they're saying something like that is happening. But that's why it's so important, I think, to, it sounds like you're in the evaluation process, definitely have someone, if they're allowing observers right now during the pandemic, to come in and observe. The best thing for me as an OT was to observe before I saw the student knew me, right? So I was like an outsider. They didn't know, oh, teacher Laura is coming to observe me. I'm going to be on my best behavior. They didn't know me from like another like lunch monitor person. So I would go in and observe. I think a third party observation is very helpful, especially or going into it, making sure that the teacher understands that you're not there to like pinpoint the teacher being at fault for it, but you want to give your child, you know, you want to get context more and environment more.
Yeah. Yeah. And another thing I would say with transitions in general, is, you know, if there's a way that the teacher can make the transition fun. I know one of my classic things that I like to do when I'm transitioning kids from one place to another place is I'm like, oh, let's hop on the boat. And then we have to do something called name to face, which is I have to look at my roll call sheet and I have to say the name of the child. And then I have to look at each individual child. I have to match the name with the face to make sure that I have everyone that we're moving, you know, from one place to the next place. Then I have to do it again once we actually arrive at the place. Now, that's something in place for us as adults to make sure we keep track of everyone, but something that can be very boring for kids, and they will wander off because you're spending so much time when they're waiting and kids are getting hurt, pushed. And so something that I will do is I'll make it a game. Oh, everyone's on the boat. Everyone, you know, we got to make sure everyone's on the boat. Is so-and-so on the boat? Is Laura on the boat? Mm-hmm. Is Mary Beth on the boat? Is Christina on the boat? Mm-hmm. And so that they're kind of engaging with it, so that they're again, a part of the transition. And it's not just something that us adults are doing and expecting the kids to follow. We're making them a part of it. And then as we're moving from the, you know, room to the outside or different rooms, we'll sing, row, row, row your boat gently down the street. And then we'll sing the song, again, engaging them in the process, less likely for them to get distracted and to go and do something else. So that's something else that I would suggest. I do, you know, sometimes I do spaceships, sometimes you're going through the jungle. Sometimes
I love that. I think that the common theme like for that is even for parents at home. It's like sometimes it's much faster for us to do our adult things, checking the list, doing the roster, doing all that. It's much faster if we did it by ourselves, but there's going to be a lot less pushback. It's going to go a lot smoother if we involve the kids in it. And this is the same with like unloading the dishwasher. Like she always wants to help. And I'm like, oh, it's going to take me like three times longer than what it needs. But I know this is the connection she needs. I know this is going to keep her busy. I know that this is, you know, like, so I'll sacrifice my time or like how much extra long it takes to just involve her, fill her power cup a little bit so she feels like she is helping. But yeah, involving kids in a lot of the things that we don't think to, and a lot of those transitions will get them used to that a little bit more, and make it a lot more smoother, keep their attention a little longer for those long roll calls.
Yeah. And one other thing I want to like mention that I saw like in the comments, want to know what your thoughts are. She, or not the comments, but the question that she asked, she said that her son will go around and like hit other children in a playful manner, kind of go around. And that's something that I see too, that, you know, children will like bump, tap from an occupational therapist perspective, what do you think is happening? Why do you think he is doing that?
So from a sensory lens, I would want to see it and see, is he like seeking the touch? I have a lot of kids who really like that feeling of touch, or the input, the feedback of like hitting someone, even if it's light. A lot of them don't understand that. Like, they're like, I would like this game. Like, why doesn't my friend over here like it? Because we're all kind of just thinking of what fills our cup. And so I think those lessons about everybody is different. Everybody likes this. Some people like this. Some people don't like this. So I think from a sensory standpoint, he might be seeking it, but I wonder if it's also just a way for him to connect with his peers, and he's not really understanding how. I've worked a lot with kids like that. And it's more of a social emotional, like, and I would ask him and say, oh, it looks like you really want to play with Tommy and John over there. Maybe it looks like, are they a little busy? Let's look with our eyes and we'll explore and say, how else can we let them know we want to play with them? I'm like, should we be quiet? Should I pull his hair? I'll like say the opposite. And he'll be like, no. And I'm like, what if I said his name? He's like, we can try it. And I'm like, if he doesn't listen, should I pull his hair? No. Maybe I could try again. Maybe he's busy. Maybe I need to do this. So getting them, I like to, 4 is a great age for this, but like offering my insights as questions and being super silly to like really make the answer obvious. So they know the answer is no, or like, you should not do that. That is so silly. But like saying like the most opposite answer rather than saying, we don't hit, we don't do this, we don't do this, but kind of like getting on their level and playing with them and showing them why it wouldn't really work. But so there, sometimes it's a sensory piece, but that one, I wonder if it's just he wants to connect with his peers, doesn't know how to. That's my first go-to.
Right. And I'd say it could potentially be both, because, you know, he wants to connect with his peers and he's just like, I want to play with you. And the way that he thinks of how to enter play is bumping into them, tackling, you know, a tap, a hit, because he was trying to fill his cup up. And so that's the first thing that he does. Yeah. So I think that, you know, a lot of times they're, you know, combination of things.
I think it's kind of like, if parents in here have heard of the love languages, you know, how sometimes we give our love, we give our partner or friends or our kids love that we want to receive, but, you know, maybe physical touch isn't the way that they fill their love bucket, right? So same thing with sensory stuff. Maybe I love a lot of tight hugs, so I'm going to give my friend a tight hug, but maybe my friend's cup is so small, they can't stand it. It's really hard to understand that concept, especially at 4. I mean, even as adults, it's hard for us to kind of feel, to remember like, well, they don't like loud sounds, but I love blasting loud music. It's really hard to do that. And then listen to that. And then also keep yourself regulated without disturbing other people. That's really hard for kids to do. And then when you're in the environment of a classroom and you're trying to stay regulated with sounds and sights and smells and feelings and all of that, and you want to regulate yourself, but then are, you know, in turn are kind of inadvertently hurting others or distracting others, and that can be really hard too. So I feel for that for him.
It's so true. And especially as someone who, you know, the love of my life is the opposite of me, is very different from me. We're not, maybe not opposites on every single thing, but we're just very different people.
Yeah.
And so, no, a lot of things that I like to do and the way that I like to do it is very different from the way that she likes to do things. And, you know, like I have to take a step back with my, you know, decades of experience in life. And okay, like she looked that way. And then not only just take the perspective, and then it takes the critical thinking of, okay, well, what's a way to do it instead? Or what's a way that we can kind of compromise? Mm-hmm. And that's what you really want to build. And that's a skill that you really, you know, want to build. And, you know, when you like do the, should we pull it, you know, should we pull their hair and ask the questions? Like, I love it, because then they get to be, they get to tell you the answer. They have to think, you know, for them to answer that question, they have to think about it and then respond, as opposed to just saying the, well, we don't want to hit them, or we don't, you know, making them a part of it. And so they're a lot more invested in it, and they're really thinking about, and then it's less about like, like this adult's telling me, you know, not to hit, but I kind of like feel like hitting this other child. And it's more about, we don't hit. And well, what else can I do? It goes, thought process, just the way that we word it.
Yeah, I think that's a big piece that we need to mention is that then what can you provide? Because you don't want to just say stop hitting, right? We often know that kids, that's like a red button. You tell them to stop doing something, they'll do it more and a little harder. My daughter is definitely in that phase. You have to tell them what they can do and often and often and often just keep doing it. I always tell her, hey, your hands need a job, squeeze your hands. You can push a wall, you can't push mommy. You can hit the pillow, you can't push mommy. I'm not going to let you hit me. It's not totally in her head yet. It's still not like it, when she's in fight or flight mode, it still happens. But almost every single day we have this conversation and she's not tired of it. It's soaking in her head. She knows the script. She knows what to do. And sometimes she'll teach her stuffed animals this. I think it would be great if you taught him these tools that he can do and then let him teach the class. Say, hey guys, I learned, if you feel like you're feeling frustrated, this is what you can do. I learned the superpower. You can squeeze your hands. Let him teach other kids because everyone can benefit from this as well. And that's why I also feel like it's important to teach kids about their sensory cup because everyone has one and you can go around and like do show and tell, but with your sensory cup. Music fills my sensory cup. And then, you know, Johnny's sensory cup gets filled by high fives or whatever it is. Right. And so, you know, whoa, I don't like high fives, but he does. That's different. Like just really starting to understand. I think four, some people may think four is too young for a lot of those things, but I think it's really, it's such a good age and such a perfect time to start educating about everybody has different wants and needs, and that's okay. But, and then I think giving him the tools to express what he needs and us showing him that we understand, I understand there's something that's hard for you about leaving the playground. I understand there's something hard for you about wanting to connect with your friends. Let me give you these tools. And I think teaching him that will go a long way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that we've went through this whole question. We're kind of at our time. Is there anything lastly that you want to say that you want to, you know, plug your stuff or just last words, anything you want to say was to wrap it up, Laura?
Last words I would probably say for any parents out there right now experiencing this, just know that sensory processing is something that everybody does. And I think no matter where you're at in your parenting journey, no matter how old your child is, I like to really encourage parents to be more comfortable about talking about sensory needs or emotional needs at home every day, making it more and more normal to say, my cup is overflowing. I say this all the time so she understands this, so that parents can take care of yourself without making your child feel, you know, responsible for you feeling overwhelmed. Just say, oh, my mommy's cup is starting to get too full. There's been a lot of loud sounds today. I just need a minute to take a deep breath. So really modeling your self-regulation can go a long way for sensory kids without sensory needs, emotional needs, whatever that is. Get really comfortable about talking about that. And if you want to message me on Instagram, I'm always there at the OT Butterfly and have a lot of posts on sensory regulation and emotional regulation that I could direct people to if they want any more information on that.
What's my name? What's my name? What's